Hello and welcome to The Forum with me, Bridget Kendall, where today we're exploring Andy Warhol, the American artist and cultural icon who once declared that in the future, everyone will be world famous for 15 minutes.
It's Warhol, actually.
Andy Warhol died in 1987, but he was immortalised in that song by David Bowie, who was a great admirer, and his fame lives on through his iconic pop art. His pictures of familiar American brands, like cans of Campbell's soup and bottles of Coca-Cola, and his portraits of instantly recognisable global superstars, like Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, and Chairman Mao of China. Warhol has been credited with helping to define and foresee the modern world's obsession with brands and celebrity. He was adept at mythologizing not just everyday objects, but even himself. But he was also seen as an enigmatic, somewhat subversive figure, linked to a bohemian underworld, as well as a glittering array of celebrities.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall.
So behind the trademark mop of silvery hair and heavy-rimmed glasses, who was the real Andy Warhol? Where did he come from? And what were the influences that shaped him? With me to explore his life and work are Eric Shiner, the New York-based artistic director of London's White Cube Art Gallery and former director of the Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, USA. Professor Jean Wainwright, an art historian and critic, and an expert on Andy Warhol. And the American illustrator and artist James Warhola, nephew of Andy Warhol, who'll be able to tell us what he was like at home. Welcome to you all, and I want to start by asking each of you very briefly, in your view, what is the main reason why Andy Warhol remains such an iconic figure? James.
Well, I guess in the long view, looking back, I mean, he's been so influential in the art world, and it's hard to believe it. His popularity is, you know, influence has gotten so great. I can't explain it except that he was at a place at the right time, and he came into the art world ready to pursue his craft, which was pop art.
Jean, what do you think?
Well, I think that's a great question. Why has he endured? And it's because everybody can have their own Warhol. Not only did he make work in painting, in photography, he was involved in the fashion world. He managed a pop group. He was the first person to do these huge multimedia, wonderful pop concerts. Also, he was a man that really understood that in the future, we will be interested in the past. We will be interested in what people sounded like and looked like. And he saved all those faces, all those voices, all those wonderful experiences he had from media, from film, and kind of mixed them all up in this amazing amount of work that he relentlessly spilled out, because he absolutely knew that the more you left behind you, the more there would be for people to explore and reevaluate over the centuries.
Eric, what's your view?
I agree completely with Jean, and unlike any other artist known to mankind, Andy had his finger directly on the pulse of American society of his specific time and place, and by extension, that American society was being put out to the world in very new modes of dissemination, whether that be television, new video technologies that were being developed, and certainly the old school styles of film and radio. But his voice mattered, and he captured an essence of a place and an economy, a people, and really was able to take imagery from the mainstream, from mass media, regurgitate it, and put it back out to us so that everyone in the world could immediately identify and connect. He thus democratizes art unlike anyone that had ever done so before. And that's why we remember him today.
He shot to fame in the early 1960s. Eric, what do you think it was about that time that made him become a hit?
When you think about it, the Andy Warhol story is completely unheard of in the art world. Andy was already in his early 30s. He'd spent the decade of the 1950s as a commercial illustrator, very well known within that world, and yet the average American wouldn't have known the name Andy Warhol, Andrew Warhol, Andy Warhol, or any iteration thereof, but they knew his images. When he had his first show in Los Angeles in the summer of 1962 at the Ferris Gallery with his now completely famous soup cans, it was as though a shockwave had been set off into the world. People could not believe that someone had the audacity to paint a soup can, something so quotidian from a grocery store shelf. How on earth could this be considered high art? And all of a sudden, he became the most buzzed about artist, first in New York, and very quickly, by extension, the world. This is incredibly rare, and it was through his audacity, through his ability to provoke, that he became an overnight sensation, even though he was already kind of famous.
Well, we've heard a little bit about him and his art. Let's go back to Andy Warhol's early life to understand where he came from. James Warhol, Andy Warhol was your uncle. So tell us a bit about the family background, where he lived and who his parents were.
Well, his mother and dad immigrated from presently Eastern Slovakia, but it was from a Rusyn village. And of course, they came in as Czechs, Czechoslovakia. It was the formal name of the country at the time, but they were neither Czech or Slovak. They were Carpathian Rus, which is a Slavic group that's become a little more popular in its identity in recent years. But I think it's important to make the distinction because they were like mountain people living very primitively, and they came in their early 20s to America and immigrated in early 1900s and set up shop in Pittsburgh. And of course, they had three boys immediately, and it was my father, Paul, and John, and Andy was the last one, 1928. He grew up knowing how hard his parents worked. All the boys were expected to work hard. And of course, it was a difficult time. It's
1928, this would have been the years of the Great Depression and then the Second World War, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And he was he had a kind of a fragile upbringing. Of course, he had some childhood illnesses like scarlet fever and a few other things. But so he was a bit pampered. His mother worked with him. She was very creative in her own right. And her name was Julia, my grandmother. And she was a very big influence on his early life, and I think she's the key to his unique outlook on life.
James, what are your earliest memories of your Uncle Andy?
Well, of course, I was born in the 50s, so he was already in New York living with my grandmother. My grandmother followed from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She followed him to New York, and she took care of him. So my earliest memories of him is doing illustration work. He'd be up at his drawing table late at night looking at shoes and using this wonderful ability to illustrate shoes. And it really stuck with me. And of course, it influenced me to the point where I wanted to be an illustrator also. But he was a very, very hard worker. He worked long hours. So he was very unique. I mean, most of my other uncles were blue-collar workers who worked in the steel industry in Pittsburgh. And here we had an artist uncle doing fashion illustrations, all this beautiful artwork in New York.
You still have the original family name of Warhol, don't you? But he dropped the A and changed his name from Warhol to Warhol. Do you know why?
Well, there's different theories, but it's very simple in that he just felt it was easier to say, and I think people recognized it as being easier to say, and they'd rather call him Warhol instead of Warhola. And it was immediate. I think when he got his first job doing the article for Glamour magazine in 1949, they dropped the A off, and he became Andy Warhol instead of Andy Warhola.
Gene, we talked already about how Warhol was very close to his mother and she was a big influence on him. What about other influences on him?
I think there were many influences on Warhol at different times of his life. So as a child, he had an art teacher who greatly inspired him. Then when, of course, he was working in the illustration world, he had people who supported him and recognised him. But his mother was a huge influence on him. And actually, Warhol was a great collector and a hoarder. He didn't throw things away. He valued things. He definitely got that from his parents. So I would say that his parents and his mother, her thriftiness, her ability to turn, you know, as a humble soup can into something that she could sell with little paper flowers in it or sometimes cut out metal flowers, I think were hugely influential. And religion. Going to church, going to the local church, and his mother was very religious.
So there was the young Andy Warhol in Pittsburgh, already a talented drawer, winning local competitions, going to art classes, eventually going to college. And then in 1949, he moved from Pittsburgh to New York. And as we heard, he changed his name to Warhol and worked as a commercial artist for magazines and also designed advertising and window displays. Eric, was this a good time to be an illustrator in 1950s America?
It was the best time to be an illustrator. And not only did Andy work, of course, for print advertisers, but he also worked for department stores and Tiffany & Company and major retailers, doing everything from their Christmas cards through to their advertisements. And he had so many gimmicks. Not only was his artwork magical and taking people to a completely happy place with the cakes and the butterflies and the wonderful pastel colors that he populated them with, but he also was quite good as a personal brand agent of himself in that he would oftentimes make sure that his clothes weren't ironed. People would call him Raggedy Andy. He would not use a regular portfolio. He would use a paper bag and pull these wonderful drawings out of a wrinkled paper bag. So he would also be called Paper Bag Andy. And a lot of editors, creative directors would feel badly for this poor kid from Pittsburgh who was just trying to get by.
But you're saying it was an act.
To them, it wasn't an act. It was a tool. And the great thing is people hired him again and again and again through this great combination of his talent and his packaging.
And then he decided to move to more art-based work. Tell us about
Absolutely.
That, Eric.
Absolutely. Well, he'd always dreamed of being a fine artist, and he was always doing paintings on the side and experimenting with his blotted line technique on canvas, that being a transfer process very similar to a monoprint where he would trace out a drawing that he had done with ink, put a clean piece of paper, fold it over and tamp it down, given a broken line in the end result. So he was experimenting always, thinking about how can I be known as a fine artist?
Yeah, it didn't take long for these Andy Warhol art pieces, which are still so recognisable today, to begin to be exhibited. We keep talking about Campbell's soup tins, Coca-Cola bottles, but also faces of well-known celebrities. And in 1962, he took part in the International Exhibition of New Realists in New York, which was the first important survey of pop art. Eric, explain to us what pop art is and when it first appeared.
Well, of course, pop comes from the term popular, things from our everyday lives. So, of course, Richard Hamilton, the British artist, was already working in this realm of pop, cutting out images from magazines, making wonderful collages of idealized worlds with bodybuilders and commercial objects populating a domestic space. And Jasper Johns, Robert Rauschenberg, many of the great names that we celebrate today from American art were also thinking about household objects, products, and experimenting with them in their art making. And it was really Andy with the soup cans that became the poster boy of this movement because they were so crazy and so against the machine, so against abstract expressionism that people had to take pause and talk.
Well, before long, Andy Warhol was becoming both popular and controversial, beginning to explore other types of art, collaborating on silk screening, making experimental films, setting up a studio known as The Factory, which became a meeting point for young artists and actors and musicians. James, when did you become aware just how successful your uncle was becoming? And what did you and the rest of the family think about it?
Well, I should first say that he kind of kept the two worlds apart. Like, he had his family world with living with his mother, and then he had two brothers with large families that would come to visit quite often. And so we'd be at the house. And, of course, the early pop images all the way through the soup cans and the Marilyns, they were all done at home. We witnessed that. We saw what he was doing. It was very intriguing and wonderful, and we didn't really know his fame until maybe he was mentioned in Time magazine in the beginning, and we were kind of proud of him for being mentioned in a major national magazine. A few other things made us aware that he was just becoming more popular. Although I think that in those early years, it wasn't exactly easy selling the art. I think the art, it took a while before he made a living off of it. In fact, I think he kept his, I remember him doing illustration work and having an assistant help him there at home all the way up into the mid-60s, yep, because that was his bread and butter. And the pop art was, you know, it was a great idea. It got noticed, and there was a few big collectors that bought it, but there was a lot of artwork left at home that he just stored. And I think that, we were very, you know, intrigued, but he kept our world apart from his world when he created the outside studio called The Factory.
Isn't it also true that he would sometimes enlist family members to help with his work? Did you help him out? And how old were you, and what did you do?
Oh, yeah. At home, when he was doing the early pop art paintings, you know, the silk screens that were smaller, he realized my brother and I were very good workers because we worked in my dad's junkyard. We were very good with our hands, and he started to put us to work doing different things around his home studio, such as stretching canvases. That was great. We loved it. I mean, it kind of kept us occupied. We didn't irritate him with our rambunctiousness, and we were stretching canvases for him, and we got pretty good at it. So those early days were fantastic. And then later on, of course, he got the outside studio in 1963-64, and so he did most of his artwork outside the house, and we didn't really visit him very often at the factory. When we'd ask him, gee, Uncle Andy, we'd like to stop down to see you at the factory, he says, oh, you'd find it boring. And the few times we went down there, he was just very busy working. It was nothing like crazy, like we would hear about.
So his public artistic persona, James, was somewhat enigmatic and mysterious. And it's very interesting to hear from you what the private Andy was like. What was he like with family and friends? Was he a very different sort of person from that public persona?
Well, of course, with family, he was different. He was very engaging and very conversational. He had a great sense of humor. He loved to laugh. He was very comfortable, especially with us kids. I think that his persona in the public kind of developed from his shyness with new people. Being put on the spot quite often made him enigmatic and kind of like awkward. I think that was a true kind of personality aspect. He didn't kind of fake it or anything. He was just not very easy to loosen up with people he didn't know. But at family, you know, family gatherings, he was like, you know, just any family member, very talkative.
He certainly could be very awkward in interviews. In fact, he usually was. James, could you read for us what he said of himself in 1966?
If you want to know all about Andy Warhol, just look at the surface of my paintings and films and me. And there I am. There's nothing behind it.
Oh, you wanted to come in there, Jean.
Yes, I wanted to come in there because that's such a great quote. But he never actually said it because it was actually in a conversation, an interview with Gresham Burke. And what happened was that she kind of put the words into his mouth afterwards when it was printed, although later he does say it as if he had said it. But actually, he never said it the first time. She had said to him, so your work is all about surface. And he says, yeah. So there's really nothing behind it. And he says no. So it's a great quote because it's a great example of Warhol taking on board something and then taking it back as his own.
Fascinating. And here's another example of him being interviewed on the BBC by the British art critic Edward Lucy Smith in 1981.
Andy Warhol, would you describe yourself as a solitary person or as a sociable person?
Just a person.
And what sort of person are you now? Do you think you've changed very much since you became famous as an artist?
No, I'm really the same person.
I asked you this question because at the moment you seem to be very concerned with painting celebrities.
No, I paint anybody. Anybody that asks me.
How do you choose to paint somebody? Just because they ask?
Yeah, that's the only way.
So the fact is that they choose you rather than you're choosing them?
Yes. Mm.
You can hear the frustration of the interviewer, can't you? That they feel they'd like to get a bit more from this famous artist, but he's giving not very long answers. James, does that resonate with the uncle you knew? This is the public persona, isn't it? Not the chatty uncle from who you remember from family occasions.
Sure, I can understand him just trying to kind of get through the interview with nothing too deep as far as giving too much information. I don't really think he said he talked about his what he did that much. I think it was he worked on instinct. I don't think he could describe it. He couldn't analyze it that well. I think it was all instinct. And so, like, when I hear him interviewed and he might be put on the spot to kind of give a deeper answer, he doesn't do it.
Eric, what's your take about this image that was projected by these interviews, which are really very reticent? Was he doing this, as James said, because he didn't want to be put on the spot? Or was there something else going on? For a man who seems so interested in shaping brands and in shaping his own public image.
I've always thought that he decidedly was careful about what he said and who he said it to. And through what means. He was a great artful dodger, and he was also a really great branding specialist. And, you know, he really did like to get people off the scent. And, for example, when asked where he was born, he would sometimes say Cleveland, sometimes say Buffalo, other times say Pittsburgh. Any Rust Belt city would do. But it was all in an effort to create a mythology around himself so that no one ever really knew the real Andy Warhol.
Let's take a closer look at his later life and work, including the factory, his legendary studio. Gene, what do we know about what the atmosphere was like? Was it a very bohemian place with lots of famous people dropping in and out? Or was it more of a serious workplace? Or was it both?
Well, there were different factories, and the one that people know most about probably was called the Silver Factory from 1963 to 1967. And the fact about that was it had these silver walls. Everybody who went there commented on this, that everything had been painted silver. So there was a real bohemian atmosphere there.
Eric, how do you think he managed to achieve so much output at the factory amidst all the visitors and the networking? It seems like an incredible synthesis of a production line of artwork and all this celebrity glamour.
Andy was just so incredibly good at multitasking, first off, but at the same time, he was also a true workaholic. He was working nonstop all of the time. And it's just so important for people to realize that he was able to keep all of these balls in the air, juggling all aspects of his life that were necessary to make him as world famous as he became.
Gene, tell us a bit about the other areas of work he did, film, for example, and in particular, The Chelsea Girls, which I think has been described as an early iteration of reality TV. Why was that?
Well, The Chelsea Girls, I think, is one of Warhol's most fascinating films. It's made up of 12 reels of film. And there was something very clever about this because Warhol realised he wanted to put these films together that he'd made. And they were all roughly about the Chelsea Hotel, an iconic hotel in Chelsea in New York, where a lot of people, different people, were living. And it is a fascinating anthropological romp through these extraordinary characters he knew and filmed.
And he also was an inveterate recorder of conversations, wasn't he? Reels and reels of audio diaries, which you, as part of your PhD, went and listened to most of, right? So well, what can you tell us about them?
He certainly was. He got his first recorder in 1964 and actually, ironically, taped things off the radio, kind of footsteps approaching and things like that. But he was fascinated about how people spoke and what people would say to each other. But also, they were receptacle to collect ideas. But he didn't just tape people. He taped noises. So he taped the water coming out of old rusty pipes in the Chelsea Hotel. He taped dinner party conversations. And he was always trying to get the story. He loved voices. And one of the things he said, actually, when he was asked who he would like to meet, he said, well, I'd really like to meet the woman who does the voice for the talking clock, because she's one of the most famous voices in the world.
What do you think he was doing with all of this, Eric? Because on the one hand, all these noises, and it's like his art, isn't it? It's taking everyday material and turning it into something that's worth looking at closely and preserving. But then on the other hand, it sounds almost like a prefiguring contemporary social media, documenting everything and sharing it.
That's exactly right. And he thus becomes the great documentarian of the 20th century, constantly recording all aspects of his life, proving that he was there, proving what he did, proving what he heard, proving what he saw. And he realizes, of course, that as his fame grows, that in the future, people will actually pay attention to these things, what his interests were, and really what he was experiencing. And as you said, Warhol himself really does become a beta version of what we now know today as social media. His celebrity portraits could certainly be compared to Facebook, the idea of taking an image of friends, people in your inner circle, and sharing them with the world. And he even went so far as to have a dream to show all of those commissioned celebrity portraits at the Metropolitan Museum of Art one day with the title, A Portrait of Society.
Gene, he also ventured into music, didn't he? Acting as the manager of an alternative experimental rock band called the Velvet Underground.
Well, that was an extraordinary experiment for Warhol. He was very interested in pop culture, and he decided that he would like to manage this band, which he had heard play at the Café Bazaar in New York. And he was fascinated not just by the lyrics, but by the band itself, and offered them a space for them to record in his factory. And also he managed and did their first album, which was the Banana album, and notorious in a way because it didn't even say the Velvet Underground on the cover. It had Andy Warhol and a yellow banana. Well, that's audacious in itself.
Let's hear a little Velvet Underground, the band so resonant of counterculture in 1960s America and managed early on by Andy Warhol.
I am tired. I am weary. I could sleep.
A very distinct 60s sound. So we have an increasingly famous artist working in his studio, The Factory, surrounded by celebrities and other artists, and pushing the boundaries not only in his work, but in the behaviour and attitudes of those around him, and indeed in himself. Eric, was he seen as a threat or as a subversive by mainstream American society?
Well, it depends who you asked. If you asked some of the abstract expressionist artists, especially from the late 1960s, especially Willem de Kooning, who literally said that Andy was the killer of all things good and the killer of beauty, the answer to that would be yes. Whereas the middle of America probably viewed his eccentricities and oddities as nothing less than dangerous, with new ideas and loose morals and all of the things that he came to represent. Whereas on the coasts and in the liberal cities of America, he was heralded as the great voice of their age and of their thinking.
And how important was his sexuality? Was he able to be open about the fact that he was gay, or was that risky in America at that time?
Oh, hugely risky at the time. And yet he was able to create his own universe. And that started off in the early days of the 1950s with other gay artists and fashion designers and his inner circle who would go to hang out at Serendipity 3, which was a great gay hangout on the Upper East Side of New York City at the time, and where Andy had his first real exhibition where he showed some of his shoe drawings, through to the 1960s, where he continued this underground aesthetic. And certainly when the films come out, he decides to cast drag queens as the movie stars, whether it was Candy Darling later on, Holly Woodlawn, Jackie Curtis. These rebel drag queens from downtown New York all of a sudden are elevated to the role of movie star. Candy Darling even appearing on the cover of Cosmopolitan magazine in the 1970s. So he's uplifting gay culture just as he's using it as his sounding board and as his safe space. And it's, of course, only in recent years that people are much more free to come out. This wasn't really an option for Andy at the time, but he figured out a way to do it.
And yet what's intriguing is the other side of his image. Alongside the bohemian, this man with an incredible work ethic, relentless by all accounts. James, was this simply a Warhola family trait, do you think?
Well, yes, I think that was part of the family and part of it, you know, how everybody was expected to work and put all their efforts into a career. And I think true of any immigrant family came to America to make it, as you know, take advantage of it and get to work and earn a living. And I think the first generation kids that were born to immigrant parents were pretty much similar in that way. And my uncle was no different. He worked like there was no tomorrow all the way to the day he passed away. I should say that, like, as far as the my uncle's period in during the factory days and the family's perspective of it, I mean, he kind of kept us, separate from that world. I mean, we had no clue to his homosexuality. Mm-hmm. He was just pretty much to himself on that front, and consistent with the religious aspects of the family. I mean, very devout Byzantine Catholic, going to church on Sundays and weekdays, and saying prayers with his mother at home. I think that we were clued into a little bit of that world of the factory through things we would read and hear about the movies and things. And I always think about my mom, who was, of course, Andy's sister-in-law, and she knew him since he was a young teenager. I remember her putting him on the spot a few times about his art, like, why are you doing soup cans, or why are you doing this, or Brillo boxes? And then I remember one time she says, Andy, it says here you're doing dirty films. And, of course, my uncle was kind of aghast and a little bit perplexed, and he would kind of counter it saying, oh, well, it's his art. It's art films, you know. But my mother was pretty pretty bold with her opinion. So I think that was not unusual in their relationship.
James mentioned there religion as being another side of him that's perhaps not so well known about, which also came from his family background. And how important do you think this was for him, Eric?
It's so critically important to fully understand Warhol to know just how important his faith was to him and to his art making. It's very easy to look at his gold Marilyn as his version of the Blessed Virgin, the Holy Mother, Mary. He, of course, grew up in a faith that really put forth the notion of the icon and beautiful Russian icons of against gold leaf of the Blessed Virgin. And it was not that far of a leap for him to take the greatest celebrity of his age and put her into the spot of one of the most famous women the world has ever known, that being Mary.
And then in 1968, a radical feminist called Valerie Solanas shot Andy Warhol, and he was seriously injured. Jean, just tell us briefly, what were the circumstances of this shooting?
Well, this shooting was very traumatic for Warhol. What happened was that Valerie came up in the elevator to his factory space. She had lipstick on, which Warhol was rather surprised about. She was a radical feminist. But there's also two very interesting points that kind of led up to this shooting as well. One was she had produced a script. So Warhol read it and was rather shocked by it and thought that she was some kind of plant to get him in trouble with the authorities. But also there's a very interesting transcript of a conversation where Valerie actually interviews Warhol and he won't give her any feedback at all. And you can almost hear her getting more and more frustrated. What happened was she shot him. She went up in the elevator. She then shot him. Warhol hid under the desk. She shot him again. She shot another factory member. And of course, he nearly died. In fact, he did feel he had died. She later that day handed herself in with the immortal words, he had too much control of my life, on my life, and said it was because he had refused to give back her script, which Warhol claimed he'd lost. So there were all kinds of very complex reasons what had happened, but it really did hugely damage Warhol.
James, the family must have also been very shocked by this terrible shooting.
Oh, it was terrible. Actually, Andy's two brothers, John and Paul, rushed to New York City from Pittsburgh because they knew that Julia, his mother, is going to be totally, just totally upset. And yeah, the word that came back was that they gave him a 50-50 chance that first night whether he was going to pull through. So it was, a very upsetting period. And I could see how it may have been a turning point for my uncle's artwork. When he made a recovery over several months. And I know that his wounds were with him for many, many years. And I think he was very slow into getting back to work. Actually, we in the family thought maybe he was going to retire from what he was doing he said something about doing family films it was, of course, he went back into the art world, but I think it was much, much more cautious. You could see it in his work, I think. He took more portrait commissions. He did things that were more safe.
Well, it's nearly time to end this conversation, but just before we go, I want to ask all three of you for your thoughts on his legacy. Jean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think I began by saying there's so much of Warhol, and even thinking about the work that we're still discovering, his photographs, his sound recordings, his movies, they're all there. They're so much. He was this wonderful anthropologist and sociologist, really, of a certain time.
And so interestingly for you, it's not the big iconic canvases. It's these little things that we're still discovering that are important.
Yes, I think so.
James, what about you? How do you view his legacy now, both as an artist yourself and as a fond nephew?
Well, I got to say that when I get together with my siblings, we still find it just incredible to believe that our Uncle Andy has become, like, he becomes more famous by every year since he's passed away. I mean, it's just, his whole life was a big art project. And I'm still discovering things about my uncle.
And Eric, what do you think? Why does he resonate still so much today?
At the end of the day, Andy Warhol was a voyeur of epic proportions who had the very rare ability to share what he saw with all of us. And at the end of the day, the real reason that we remember him is that he really redefined art, what art can be, what art can mean, who has access to art, who can make art, and whose voice matters. In so doing, he democratized the very notion of art making, and for that we can thank him and certainly remember him.
Well, there we must leave it. My thanks to all three of you for exploring the world of Andy Warhol with us, James Warhola, Eric Shiner, and Jean Wainwright. If you enjoyed this programme, you can listen to other episodes of The Forum on the world of art and artists and many other topics by going to our website. Just search for BBC The Forum. There you can also download this and other episodes as a free podcast. I'm Bridget Kendall. Thanks for listening.